Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, this is Andrew Bowser.
And I'm Sapphire Sandalo.
And welcome to Alter Weekly.
Coming up on the show, we talk with Nicole Goebel about disability representation in horror. Then we talk about the cult classic Freaks with Vanessa Guerrero. And on the Alter Society, we discuss You Should Have Left.
But first, Sapphire, we haven't done a spooky check-in in a while.
We haven't.
Is there anything to check in that's spooky in nature this week? As always, well, nothing for me.
Because your life is a waking nightmare.
Exactly.
So,
I did have a crazy nightmare the other night, but
you have to share it now.
Well, okay, it's a little real world-y.
Great.
But man, it put me on edge. I feel like I can share now because the day has come and gone and nothing happened, but it was an anxiety dream around the inauguration. And I was sitting with my wife watching TV and it was CNN. And, you know, it was one of those things, dream logic, where we were watching the inauguration, but what was on screen wasn't the inauguration.
Right.
It was actually further footage from inside the Capitol building, but it was inauguration day. There was another attack and gas smoke spread into the chamber and I jumped up off the couch and I was like, oh my God, it's happening. It's actually happening. And then people ran into the building and this time they were all armed and I just looked at my wife. And I was like, oh my God, we're about to see, you know, assassinations on live TV. And then I woke up and it was like 3:30 a.m. and I just had to get up and like do a lap around my house. I just had to walk around and sit down and take some breaths. But luckily the inauguration went off without a hitch and Lady Gaga slayed it.
We got some cool memes out of it.
We got some great fucking memes. What a meme filled. And it's like they were fun memes. They weren't the sad memes that would come out of the Trump administration where they were memes that also made us sad and angry.
Right. It's nice to sort of be in a place where we can joke about stuff that's not like so dire.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, LOL, but this is destroying our country. LOL. Hey, side note, is the witching hour 3 a.m. or midnight? Oh, wait, did we talk about this?
I don't think so.
Okay, it came up in another conversation. I've always heard the witching hour is 3 a.m.
Yes.
Okay. Do you know the history of that? I don't know. Some idiot told me midnight. I didn't agree with them.
Well, there's a couple of different theories. The first one I heard of was that like the number 3 is, this is so, I'm sure this is incorrect, but the number 3 is thought to be a mockery of the Holy Trinity. And so it's used by the devil as a mockery. But I don't think that's actually why.
Okay. Interesting.
I think that's more of like the Christian explanation for why 3 a.m. is creepy, because you know how like everything in Christianity is like taking everything that is pagan and making it evil.
You got to give it that Chris twist.
Like
and now that's time for the spiritually cool check-in. That sounded like a cue for the youth pastor to come in.
So this is just something that I learned this week that I've been thinking about all week. I can't stop. So as you know, I have another podcast where I interview people about their paranormal experiences and also people who are just really knowledgeable about the spirit world because I want to learn. Mm-hmm. And I was interviewing this girl and so I was having her basically react to these stories that I narrated about different ways that people have healed. And one of the stories is a true story. I mean, according to the person who said it to me. I believe it because I've also heard this from other people. She told the story about how when she was 10, she broke her ankle and her mom picked her up from school, didn't take her to the hospital, took her to a McDonald's. And she was like, why aren't we at the hospital? And the mom like took a napkin, took some ice water, placed it on her ankle for like a little bit. It started to burn. And then when she pulled the napkin off, her bruise was totally gone. Like the purple bruise was gone and the napkin was all purple.
Huh. Wow.
And she was fine.
Interesting.
Yeah. That, so
I know this isn't, the idea of that is a little triggering for me only because it makes me think of like Christians, what are they called? Christian scientists? Is that the people?
Oh, maybe.
Who are the people that like don't believe in going to the doctor? That's the only thing.
Maybe that's them.
And like, you know, but I know that's not what you're saying this instance was, but I do get a little freaky around things when it's like, you know, prayer or healing.
Right.
Occurred. Well, yeah.
Here's the thing. So maybe this whole conversation is going to trigger you.
Oh, no. Because,
okay, so full disclosure, I am not an anti-vaxxer. I am not anti-medicine.
Yes.
That is not what I'm discussing here.
Yes.
So when I shared that story with this woman that I was interviewing, she said that it reminded her of theta healing. Have you heard of that?
I have not heard of theta healing.
So I had never heard of this either. And so she's just learning about this. And so she explained that, okay, there's different brain, not levels. There's levels of brain states.
Okay.
You know how there's like the, is beta one of them? I forget. But one of
you're talking
brain...
the wrong guy.
You don't know all the brain states, Bowser?
Right.
So there's one that's the theta state. And that is supposedly one of the deepest forms of meditation that you could be in. And it's also called the God state. So basically the theory is that you can meditate so deeply on this level that if you eliminate everything in your body that is telling you that something is not possible,
yeah,
you eliminate all of that in that state. And when you come out of it, it's like, that's real. So basically,
well, like, to what level? You mean like Neo, like in the Matrix?
Yes.
There is no spoon type of stuff.
Kinda. Yeah.
Huh.
And that's the thing. Like it, I had to think about. Like it's all literally all I've been thinking about since I talked to her.
I bet.
And like, because you know how they always say, "Ooh, mind over matter," blah blah blah, and it's become such a cliche where we're like, "Oh, we can do anything." But here's the thing: I'm starting to think. I think we can do anything.
Oh my gosh.
Like
you're talking like that Key and Peele sketch where the basketball player is like, you can fly. You can fly.
No, but here's the other thing. That's
someone flew?
No. That's one of the beliefs that like
Whoa.
You can meditate so hard that you levitate. And here's the thing, Bowser. Here's the thing. Before you go, Sapphire, you are making this a crazy podcast.
Uh-huh.
Oh, wow. I feel like I'm going way off. I was just about to start a whole nother thing, but I'll shorten it.
Do it.
Like, I recently learned about this thing called Thukdum, which only recently became public knowledge because it was sacred to the monks who practice it. I won't get into it. Look it up. Thukdum. T-U-K-D-U-M. And they've been doing this for like years, and it truly defies everything we know about what it means to die. And so to me, I'm like, the fact that someone did like a documentary on them, on this practice.
Yeah.
So this has been secret knowledge that no one else has known until now. And like all monks do all the time is meditate. So I'm like, I am 100% convinced there are some monks somewhere in this world that are just floating around. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, it's so hard because for some reason, it doesn't bother me when I think about it from an Eastern perspective. But when I think about like Western religion, it triggers me because when I think about Christians being like, well, you're probably having health problems because that's sin manifesting in your life.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, get away from me.
And that is a very good response. Yes, because they're framing it in a way that, in my opinion, is not based on something that's helpful.
Right.
Because see, okay, here, okay. So this is the last thing I'll say.
So, it doesn't have to be. You always act like there's someone off camera giving us the wrap it up signal.
I'm getting the light.
Yeah.
So, I know, because I could seriously go on about this forever. Yeah. And we've probably already lost people. I'm so sorry. Anyways, so, okay, are you?
I love that podcast. So they start. So they started talking about those floating monks.
It's real, dude. Yeah. And I've heard of like witches who like love to. Anyways, that's totally okay. Anyways,
I mean, the thing is, like, I kind of believe it when it comes to witches and monks. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's because, and see, here's the thing, though. Us in our mere like dumb Bowser Sapphire states, we're like, okay, let me see if I can fly. Obviously, right. It's not going to work because it takes a lot of work and a lot of meditation to get to that point.
Totally.
And then, okay, where was I going with this? Oh, yes. So she was explaining how, like our body, there's like, we could like not believe something is possible so deep in ourselves that we don't even know that it's happening. And here's an example that I thought of because, okay, are you familiar with, like, have you ever heard of it's not really a theory because I believe it's true, that like we are capable of biting our own fingers and breaking them, but the reason why we can't is because our brain is stopping us from doing it. Have you ever heard
of that? Yeah. I don't know if I've heard it about fingers, but I've heard that, yes, that like you could bite through your own tongue if you wanted to, but you don't, because
our body is saying don't do that.
Yeah.
Even though it's not, you know, cause like I could try to bite it right now, but so deep down inside me, my brain is saying, you're not going to do that, bitch. And so that's what theta healing is you go down to that state, you get rid of that. And then you come back out and then you can bite your finger.
Well, hopefully that's not the end all be all.
No, but it's a form of therapy too. Because what you do is you go into that state, you say, I don't want to be anxious. I don't want, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And then, so it's a type, I might try it with her because she does it. So.
That's what I was going to ask is like, is the next step you trying it? And
yeah.
Yeah, well, God,
I'm
gonna
be floating and shit
us.
In the next podcast.
Yeah. Newsflash. That's right. It's time for your newsflash. A Quiet Place Part 2 has shifted again, this time to September 2021. Even though a third film is already being developed in this franchise, the studio is working to get the sequel into theaters in the midst of a pandemic. Originally, it was penciled in for an April release, but now it won't come out until September 17th, 2021. AMC is bringing back Eli Roth's History of Horror for a third season. Eli Roth said, I'm beyond thrilled to continue this incredible deep dive into horror history with all these legends, rising stars, and fans. I'm so thankful to all those who have come together to celebrate and catalog the genre we love in a show that will play for generations to come. The upcoming third season will feature episodes entitled Sinister Psychics, Infections, Mad Scientists, Apocalyptic Horror, Sequels That Don't Suck, and Holiday Horror. Edgar Wright's Last Night in Soho will be coming out around Halloween. Focus Features is now releasing this psychological horror on October 22nd, 2021. Last Night in Soho stars Anya Taylor-Joy and Thomasin McKenzie. It's set in London during the 1960s, and plot elements have been largely kept under wraps. But Edgar Wright says, it will feel very different to my other films, but I've always liked films which have a slow burn into something else, and a lot of my movies have that feeling. And that's it. That's your newsflash.
Newsflash.
Nicole Goebel is a disability advocate and podcast host of the show Bodies of Horror. Here's our conversation with her about disability representation in the genre.
Nicole, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. So tell us a little bit about your show Bodies of Horror and how it came about.
So I have always been a huge horror fan. I'm an individual with a disability. And, you know, ever since I kind of stumbled upon my first horror film, I was able to kind of make all of these connects to kind of my experience and how horror presented, you know, particularly body horror, kind of presented those experiences. And so I believe it was Joe from Horror Queers and Val had, you know, sent out a tweet saying, hey, we're looking for people that you know, have some interesting things that they want to say about horror. We're building up this podcast network, and we would love to have some different voices on there. And so I sent in my pitch, and the rest, as they say, is two episode history right now.
Did you know what your first episode would be when you submitted this pitch? Or how did you come to decide what you'd cover in your first episode?
So when I sent in my pitch, it was pretty kind of your standard issue, you know, just give kind of a high level idea of what you want to cover. You didn't have to do an episode breakdown. But once they had gotten back to me and said, yeah, we're really interested, we want you to break out 12 episodes. And give like a little descriptor. So yeah, since then I've just kind of followed that map. So it was really about thinking in terms of where are some of those more interesting things that I think haven't been discussed, you know, really trying to make a mix of, you know, films that we hear covered on various podcasts, you know, pretty frequently, and saying, oh, but here's a different spin on it versus films that maybe some people haven't really considered as being relevant to disability.
I was super excited to see that in your first episode, you covered The Exorcist and Dr. Giggles.
Mm. Yes.
I'm glad that you didn't, that you're not shunning some of the lesser known or less prestige-y entries into the genre.
Well, I have no idea what you're talking about.
That's where Bowser shines.
That is truly where I shine.
So actually, something that I really loved that you shared was the story of how, what it was, Dr. Giggles, that was the movie that you said was sort of like a conversation starter at a sleepover for you. Yeah, and you mentioned that it, because the character in the movie had a heart condition, and you kind of used it as a way to explain to your friends like some of the stuff that's happening with you. So I guess, like, what are your thoughts on the importance of good horror movies or good representation of disabilities in horror movies?
Well, I mean, I think it goes without saying that representation, good representation in all aspects is very important. I think when we talk specifically about disability, it's really about going back and looking at films, going as far back to like Todd Browning's Freaks, and kind of moving along the spectrum and piecing apart, like, you know, where are those stories that we can connect with? It's not about, I think sometimes it can be a really delicate balancing act of, just because a film may lean in on some tropes that aren't great, or a storyline doesn't hit the way that you think it should, that doesn't necessarily mean it's bad. It's presenting something in a very specific way, and there's still something to take away from that. And so obviously Dr. Giggles is not 100% medically accurate in its portrayal of anything. But, you know, it was like, hey, we just watched this film. You know that heart monitor that person's wearing? That's just like mine right here. That's pretty cool, right? You know, they weren't like, oh, by the way, did you have a psychotic doctor try to kill you when you were having her surgery? No, not my experience yet. But so good representation is something that's important. It should always be strived for. And certainly when we see, you know, it falls short, we want to give voice to that. But I think any aspect of representation can be a starting point to say, hey, this is an experience that we can talk about, and then go from there.
So I don't know if either of you have noticed this type of trend, especially in recent horror movies, I'd say, or maybe I'm just noticing it more, but there's this trend where the protagonist in a horror movie has a disability, but it's almost in a way like, this is like, I'm kind of torn about this, and I'm very curious to see what your thoughts on this are, because in one way I'm like, okay, so we have a hero in a horror movie who has a disability and like the story is about them. But then on the other hand, I'm wondering, like, we're only seeing protagonists with disabilities in horror movies because that's a fear that able-bodied people have. So when they're watching it, they're going, oh wow, wouldn't it be so scary, like in The Quiet Place, you know, like to be deaf in a situation like that, or even Come Play, like how the kid was relying on that phone. Also Hush, like she was deaf and mute. You know, like, so it's, they are the heroes of the story, but then in a way I'm like, is it weird though? That, because I feel like, oh god, I don't know if I'm like explaining my thoughts very well, but I think because we don't see that many protagonists and heroes in other genres as much as we do horror, I think that's probably where the problem is. But I don't know, what do you think about all of that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, just like we are talking about with the flip side of that, with the villains, you know, to have a hero or protagonist like in Hush or A Quiet Place, which I've recorded an episode of the podcast kind of looking at both of those films side by side, because one has a deaf actor in the role, one does not. And looking at how even that influences portrayal. And one of the things that strikes me about A Quiet Place is that, yeah, she is deaf. And while that does pose additional risks for her in this environment, it also has made it easier for her to have this form of communication with her family. And because of her disability, her family now has a way to communicate with each other, not just her. They all communicate using ASL. So there's a benefit to that. One of the things that I absolutely love about A Quiet Place is that she's a protagonist and a hero at the end, not because she straps on her cochlear implant and it works. So it's not her having to fix herself to save the day, you know. So that, to me, that's like, okay, this is something, this is another little layer that we're adding in into these stories. That's really interesting. And I like that. And like with Hush, you are kind of deconstructing the damsel in distress, particularly the disabled damsel in distress trope. And so I think that there's, again, I think there's a lot of different layers to them. But yeah, I mean, I think where some of that may be stunted in further development is, like you just said, we have representation here that's starting to come more to the forefront, but that's not happening in a much larger scale. You know, where's a rom-com that has an individual with a disability as a lead, things like that. So, you know, we do have to work to kind of get the picture a little bit wider.
Do you think, and not to pat the genre on its back too much, but I feel like the horror genre, even though a lot of what we discuss on this show is that it has missed the mark on inclusion many, many times, I also feel like you can point to instances within the genre where it was more forward thinking in inclusion. Do you agree with that? And if so, why? Why is the horror genre seemingly a better genre in representing different types of people?
Because that's its foundation. I mean, we go all the way back to like Universal Monsters, the classic monster tales. Those are tales about disability. And so it's built into the foundation. You know, again, one of my favorite subgenre is body horror, just because obviously there's such a direct parallel to these really complex stories of how we're interacting with our bodies. So again, I think that the horror genre as a whole has really left a door open for more nuanced tales of that kind of circle back to themes that are relevant to disability, because it's, at the end of the day, take kind of all of the specific elements away from horror, these are just stories about people trying to survive day to day. And we all do that. It's universal. And one of the unique things that horror interjects into it is they start to put in those hurdles, those roadblocks, those challenges that make it more thrilling. So, and that's something that, you know, obviously is relevant to the disability experience. Like, one of my favorite characters in horror, period, is Franklin from Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And people are like, what? He's the worst character ever? And it's like, no, he's absolutely not. By any stretch of the imagination, I'm sorry to inform you. And, you know, when you hear people talk about, I can't remember what podcast it was, but I was listening to an episode on Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and they were saying, you know, there's no way that you could have a character like this in a film today. And I question that, because I'm like, what about the character is wrong? Huh. It's the situation. It's the fact that, of course, his situation is going to be a lot different. The van is going to be accessible. So you're not going to have someone have to put out little pieces of wood to get him in and out. He's going to have a chair that's going to make him a little bit more mobile and autonomous, and being able to get around instead of depending on, you know, folks to stop ditching him and actually push him around and be there to support him. So it's, you know, there's just a lot of things that you can go back and look at these films. And I do it all the time. Like, I'll put on some movie I haven't seen in forever, just be like, oh, I haven't seen it, I remember liking it, I'll watch it, and I'll be like, whoa, this is absolutely mind-blowing, this is a complete, like, interesting narrative that I had not picked up on before.
So that's what great. Are some things that you would like to see more of in future horror movies, and what are some things you would like to see a lot less of?
Oh, I would like to see a lot more actors with disabilities being cast in these roles. You know, like, if you're going to go back and remake Texas Chainsaw Massacre again, you know, let's not cut out Franklin, and let's have someone that uses a wheelchair in that role. That could be a basic place to start. I would love to see more of that. I would love to see individuals with disabilities behind the camera and writing their own stories as well. I think that's really imperative. And of course, this is all to say, you know, a lot of the examples that we talk about are visible disabilities, but invisible disabilities also exist. And so, you know, when we talk about someone that has disabilities or doesn't, there's a lot of assumptions that can go into play. Because I don't, you know, I can walk by someone on the street, and they may have an invisible disability. And I would know, but I wouldn't think of them necessarily as being a person with a disability right away. So to say all that, to say that there aren't individuals with disabilities behind the camera writing these stories, I think it's hard to say, but would love to see even more folks kind of getting their voices heard in that respect. What I'd like to see less of is, kind of in that same vein, co-opting of these stories and experiences. You know, really let us tell these stories, and don't, you know, take our stories and our experiences and then kind of funnel them through, you know, the voice of someone that doesn't really understand it. You know, that's one of the issues that I have, for example, with the movie Hush. The disability is completely sidelined, and it's portrayed in ways that I think are really strange. And it's kind of hard for me to talk about specifically, because it's just kind of in the whole package. It just doesn't really seem authentic. And I talk a little bit more about that in the episode, but because it's, you know, it was written and acted out by individuals that don't have that experience. Not to say they didn't do their homework, because they certainly did, but individuals that live that experience bring so much richness to those stories. So yeah, that would be something that I would like to see. And of course, like we talked about before, you know, I would like to see more people just willing to have conversations and say like, yeah, maybe this portrayal isn't great. That doesn't mean the movie isn't good. Doesn't mean this character isn't interesting. It's an example. It's getting us to think about more abstract ideas, and that's good.
Well, this has been super insightful. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you. This has been so wonderful. I've listened to your guys' podcast and it is phenomenal. So I really appreciate the work that you guys are doing.
Thank you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
In today's Better Off Dead, we talk with Vanessa Guerrero, comedian, writer, and self-professed horror dork. We're discussing whether or not the 1932 cult classic Freaks could be remade for a modern audience, or is it better off dead?
All right, Vanessa, thank you for joining us. We're looking forward to this conversation around Todd Browning's Freaks. First up, when did you see the film, and were you a fan of the film? This is a question for both of you, Sapphire and Vanessa. How did you get introduced to Freaks?
My first introduction to Freaks actually was just like all of the pop culture references around it, whether it be Simpsons or the Ramones song. Mm-hmm. I had the older sister that's just like cooler than you in every way. So she had seen everything before me. So I'd like that's talked good. About it and I was like, oh, that's such a weird lyric. And she's like, oh no, that's actually from a movie. I'm almost 100% sure she probably like got it off of like Napster or some kind of torrent.
Yeah.
Because she had it on like a DVD that just said Freaks on it.
Yeah.
And she showed it to me, and it was one of just those entry points in which I was like way too young, but I fell in love with it immediately. Mm-hmm. It was so much my jam, and like growing up in Orange County that has such like a pretty veneer on it, whenever I'd play hooky to Venice that had a lot of sideshow attractions and had a lot of like you know, freak show style museums of Venice in its heyday. So it's always been a huge appeal to me, and I love Freaks.
Yeah. Sapphire, what about you? When did you first see the film?
My story is not as interesting. I saw it yesterday for the first time.
That's fine. Hey. So what did you think? It's always funny because we'll have different points of entry for a lot of these things. And so we'll talk about a movie that I might love, but I have kind of rose-colored glasses toward it because I saw it when I was a kid. And Sapphire watched it this week and she's like, you know, it's dumb, right, Bowser? And I'm like, you're right, it is dumb. But that may not be true about Freaks. What did you think about Freaks?
I mean, like, so overall, I did enjoy it. And I, going into it, I kept thinking, wait, is this supposed to be a horror movie? Like,
right.
I kept thinking of that through the whole time because nothing felt scary to me. And then I thought, oh, is it the fact that they're all sideshow performers? Is that the horror aspect?
Right.
And then I don't know. So that's sort of what I was thinking. I did enjoy it.
Yeah. It's a weird film to take in. For me, I saw it in film school, and we actually saw it on film. And I remember being really engaged and also kind of confused in regard to, right, am I supposed to take this as horror because of the characters and the people you're showing me, because I don't find them horrifying, but was that how they were presented to an audience at the time. But then there's a lot of sympathy and nuance to the characters. And so I don't know that they were purely being objectified. But anyway, then I didn't rewatch it until this week. And I kind of just had the same questions when I watched it this week. Is the film objectifying and exploitative in ways toward these performers? Because for those that don't know, Todd Browning cast performers with disabilities, and they're our main characters. How do you feel about his portrayal of these people?
I think also some back context also helps in terms of knowing how much was cut out based on what studio requested.
And I don't know much about that.
So Freaks is actually about 30 minutes. What we know is about 30 minutes shorter than what the original product was supposed to be.
Yeah. It's a lot of time.
It's 30 minutes. And almost exclusively, other than like some scenes in which Cleopatra and Hercules were like further punished, almost exclusively a big chunk of that time are more humanizing scenes for those actors, more scenes of like them at home, them having their interpersonal relationships, just more day-to-day actions, because the studio didn't feel the same empathy and the same desire to humanize these actors the way Todd Browning originally did. Because when he wrote the perspective, like when he wrote it as a horror movie, it was initially supposed to be a Lon Chaney thing, but Lon Chaney died. And so he wrote this based off of a different story and very much wanted his villains and his like terrifying characters to be Cleopatra and Hercules. But when studios initially saw it, not only were they horrible to Todd Browning and the actors on set, F. Scott Fitzgerald walked in on the actresses that played the conjoined twins and like allegedly like ran out and barfed and wrote some story that he probably lifted the best parts from Zelda anyway.
But they
were actively very against the castings and also just these actors in general. So after that first screening, they demanded that a lot of these more empathetic, humanizing scenes be cut, because for them, their perspective was, we're scared of something that's different than what we know. We're afraid of anything not cookie cutter.
Well, I guess that would make sense then why I would still find the presentation of it somewhat confusing, because it does feel like if I can say, its heart is in the right place.
But
then the material isn't there to match what I'm kind of assuming its heart is. I mean, it is there in pieces. I was surprised at rewatching it how much of the day-to-day was included, and that it did feel kind of slice of lifey in a way I didn't remember, only because the parts that get digested by pop culture are the bigger elements, the more theatrical elements, and obviously the gooba gobble.
We accept her.
Exactly. Do you think what was in that cut footage would have changed the way culture accepted this film? Would it be as much of a cult film, you know, or because it's so bite-sized? Part of me thinks that's why it's lasted. It's an hour long.
Yeah. I feel like the bite size helped for its resurgence in the 60s when it was, you know, rediscovered and people fell in love with it again. But I feel like the extra 30 minutes would put it even further into contention now. Because there's so many movies that specifically like live in the realm of horror movies, usually focused on like someone with disabilities, that doesn't actually have any, or it's not written by people that have like experienced or been around anybody. And Todd Browning like grew up in these traveling shows, so he had like a genuine Freaks was a tribute to the people that he grew up around. And so many of the times that you see this done now, it's done so much from a voyeuristic setting that I think the additional 30 minutes would put it back into these discussions of like, why aren't we holding the same amount of standards now, where it's like, why is your cast all able-bodied?
Yeah. What do you think, both of you, about the themes that this movie's running off of? A lot of people have analyzed it to be about class. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be about a number of things. It can also be very literal in the sense that it's about the dynamics within this working group of performers that are all part of this traveling show. But then I guess from a macro level, a lot of people have taken it to be a message about class. How do you take its themes?
I say a big one, mostly because it was a big conversation in 1932 as well. Freaks is a big, loud and clear message for anti-eugenics themes. Mm-hmm. It was something that was in, you know, heavy discussion in the 30s in terms of like what the prime specimen is, what kind of human you want to breed, and like, can they have sexual lifestyles? Can they reproduce? And, you know, we only want to foster that. And there are so many of the performers in Freaks that like have sexual relationships, have sexual agencies. Like the conjoined sisters both have separate sex lives, and mm-hmm. it's not presented as anything that's like particularly difficult. It's just something that they manage because yeah. they're just two different women with like two different ideas of what they want in their partners. And honestly, I can't really think of anything since that also highlights that. And so much of Freaks, especially for where it was in the 30s, has such a strong anti-eugenics theme because mm-hmm. it's like this is just how, when, you know, way before we actually have accommodations, when you just give somebody autonomy, they get to live.
Sapphire, did you have any misconceptions about the film before watching it? Like, did you think you kind of knew what it was going in? And were you surprised at any point? Like, did you know the poster or kind of know the mythos around it? But
Like I had only heard about it like in passing. And I don't know. It's weird because every time I hear of the movie, I always hear it paired with how it's so problematic. So I was expecting something way worse. So like while I'm watching it, I'm like, wait, this seems like it's humanizing these people. It doesn't feel like, I don't know. I felt like I was like, yeah, I'm interested in hearing, like watching their mundane life activities and seeing them just be like normal people. So I was expecting to see something that made me go, whoa, you know, but like that never happened.
I think it's also hard. We talk about this on the show a lot, that within the horror genre, even though I know there's an argument to be made that this isn't a horror film, but looking at it as a horror film, things are heightened in horror. Mm-hmm. And judgment is heightened, consequence is heightened, you know, they're often morality tales and with inevitable endings to a degree. And as I was watching this, I thought, is what's problematic about it the idea that if you wrong this people group, their only response is one of violence and to make mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. like them? Like, is that what's problematic? The idea that their vengeance is kind of reductive, but then watching it like a horror film, I'm like, but that is the natural progression of this plot.
Right.
These people are mistreating them and they will get their comeuppance. And it's poetic in the context of a horror film.
Yeah. By the end, I was like, yeah, I'm so glad that fucking bitch is punished in some way. Yeah. I was like rooting for them.
They should put that on the poster.
Like, that actually highlights what I think might be the intended horror element of the movie, which is the idea that nothing is scarier than reaping what you've sown. And when you highlight the villain as this like physically beautiful, able-bodied person, which like probably is going to be the viewer, there are so many movies that horror's main thing is empathy. Its main thing mm-hmm. is making you feel like the person feels on screen. And I feel like it works at its best too when it makes the viewer realize like, oh, I'm living on a hallowed grave and I'm the one that put that person there. Mm-hmm. And something about the fact that the villain, the only person in the movie that chances are looks like the person that's sitting in the theater, because theaters aren't really that accessible when you're not able, when you're like mm-hmm. not able-bodied anyway, anything that holds up the mirror to you is what makes it scary.
Yeah, it's almost, it's not saying, well, I don't know, I guess. I was about to say, it's not necessarily saying we should be afraid of losing able-bodiedness. It's saying Cleopatra would be, though, because she was running off of vanity and lording her ability above others, and then even taking advantage of them and seeing them as less than human.
That actually reminds me, the one part where they're like a couple of the sideshow performers are by a river, I think, and then like their teacher or something, I'm not sure what the relationship was there. And then these like two men come over and they call them like freaks and stuff. And then the woman says that they're children. So she calls them children. And that kind of made me pause a bit, because I don't believe all of those people were actually children. I think some of them were adults. So I got a little bit weird about that. So I was like, is she, you know, like, is that infantilizing them? Like, why was she calling them children?
I felt like by the end of her statement, she was more referring to them as God's children. We are all God's children. They are like, equally, they are equally God's children as any of us. I felt like was her sentiment. When she first said it to the guy, I was like, oh, interesting. She's regarding them all to be children. Because then I think when he walks away, she says to them, don't you remember what I said? Don't be afraid. All of God's children will be looked after, or something like that.
Oh, I see. Okay. I forgot about that part.
Like, I think she was then kind of cementing the point in a way that I took then more figuratively, I guess.
Interesting.
Yeah. And like biblical terminology. Well, like biblical terminology, they love using child specifically for like, that's what we all are, to like the Almighty Father, you know.
Yeah.
Like, don't infantilize me, guys.
Right? Yeah.
I am an adult.
Yes. Yeah. Well, so looking at the film through a modern lens, if you were to hear that they're remaking Freaks, is there a filmmaker or an approach that you think would make the correct version? I say in loose quotes because I don't know what I'm saying by saying correct, but what could be done with the property now by a modern filmmaker for a 2021 audience? Or is it a no-go? Is the property better off dead?
I think it's one of those things that's so hard to make now, because I mean, part of the beauty of Freaks is that it's one of the few time capsules that exist for like disabled actors of that era at all, just at all. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's so valued and so treasured, that not only is it a positive depiction where at the time you were either, you know, abandoned or relegated to like the dregs of society and you were never either on camera or highlighted, a lot of the times the only work that you can get was in sideshows. And it's such a time capsule of where it was to where we are now, and actually having these conversations and giving people with disabilities their space to express that they want autonomy and they want the ability to just live their lives, you know, same as any able-bodied person does. I don't think it's one of those things that can really be remade, because from where it was light years ahead already. It had so much more of a loving perspective. If I could have changed anything, it would have been adding those additional 30 minutes, and also, unfortunately, the able-bodied actors were blacklisted. The disabled actors were relegated to the kind of roles that MGM wanted for their freak types, which were no humanization at all, and it derailed Todd Browning's career.
Yeah.
So if there was a way to where like we could reverse time and have it be taken for what it was at the time, that would have been incredible.
Yeah.
I think that if Freaks were to be remade now, I think at least the director or the writer, like someone who's at the top, needs to be disabled or from this group. I think that if anybody else did that, because we already have movies where abled people direct and write them without having any of the knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so I think that would have to be like number one requirement. And then that's a problem. Like, I don't think I know of any. And it's not that they don't, it's not that disabled directors or writers don't exist. It's that they're not getting as much work as other people.
I'm in agreement with both of you. I think it could be really cool if the remake, quote, of Freaks was just the original restored somehow. They could find that footage, mm-hmm. reconstruct Todd Browning's original vision, and get that full cut out to an audience somehow. But from what I understand, that footage is long gone, unless someone discovers it in a canister someday in someone's basement.
It happens.
It happens.
That's why I saw a very pink print of the thing. The only 70mm that exists of the thing, people thought it was gone for the longest time. They found it in a basement and it had like some sun damage, so it's pretty pink looking, but it's the last one left and it looks good otherwise.
Yeah. Wow. Well, then here's hoping that somebody discovers a sun damaged version of Todd Browning's original. Welcome to the Alter Society. This week, we are discussing You Should Have Left, starring Kevin Bacon, Amanda Seyfried, and directed by David Koepp. Sapphire, what did you think?
I should have left the room once it started playing.
Hell yeah. I was hoping you'd say something like that. man, hard agree. Hard agree. I don't know why this movie exists.
Right.
And not to just sound like a troll, but you know, normally you watch something and even if it doesn't work for you, you're like, okay, well, I get what they thought they were doing.
Right.
Or
I couldn't get that either.
Especially because this was based on a novel. And I was like, you optioned that book to what? Make a very vague, half baked haunted house, but not really haunted house story. What? Yeah. You didn't need to base that on anything. That could have just been a really bad screenplay.
Right.
Wild to me that it just never clicked into being anything.
No.
And I am a Bacon head through and through.
Really?
Whew. You put K Bakes in there. And I'm already like, I'm halfway in at that point. So for me to not go all in, that's saying something.
Yeah.
Did you like Stir of Echoes?
I don't think I've seen that.
We should watch that for the show.
Oh, sure.
Because same director, same lead actor, very similar in premise, in ways. Stir of Echoes, they move into a house and the house just, it's haunted. but it came out the same year as Sixth Sense. And so it was kind of like, fuck off, Stir of Echoes. But I remember liking it. And I was expecting maybe a follow-up spiritually to Stir of Echoes, but this was a mess. To unpack it a little bit, do you understand what the house was to these characters?
No.
What the metaphor was? What was actual? What was imagined?
I understood nothing. The first thing I did not understand was why Amanda Seyfried is Kevin Bacon's wife. That really bothered me. I am very, very touchy when it comes to like wide age gaps, especially in movies. It just grosses me out.
And they kind of tried to mention it or make a thing of it, but they didn't really have anything to say about that. Like, it was clear he was insecure. What are the things? I don't even know where to begin talking about this because it was such a mess. But it was oddly intimate in the beginning. I was like, oh, there's actually some character here. And we're seeing some really specific moments in their lives. And even his insecurity around aging and not being allowed on the set of the movie his wife was in. Because, you know, like, he was recognized as being a possible criminal.
I thought all that was really interesting. And I was like, okay, let's see where it goes. It feels like it's going somewhere. And then it didn't go anywhere.
It didn't. It's like they didn't stick the landing. And there's I don't know. I don't have the language to explain what bothers me about this, but I'll just say the way my brain wants to say it, and you can tell me if it makes sense. It's one of those movies that didn't need me to watch it. Like, it set up its own little mystery that was just kind of about rearranging scenes and hiding information from us. And then it kind of spun it around. And then in the end, the character was like, I know what it is now. I get it. And everyone was like, okay, bye. And he's like, bye. And I'm like, okay, so y'all are good. I didn't need to be here. Like, it was just, it was like a Rubik's Cube that was sitting in one of its like little automated solvers.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes sense, but.
No, it does. It does.
Yeah. Like, I didn't know what I was meant to discover.
Mm-hmm.
Because there was no way for us to know any of the information other than just sitting and waiting for them to decide when to give it to us as exposition.
Right.
All right. Well, it's clear that you and I didn't like it, but let's take a look at what some of the altar viewers thought. Kathy C. said, the story had potential and some of the scenes were chilling. The actors were poorly cast. I would disagree, Kathy, because I love Kay Bakes. The I'm awake, I'm asleep, was it a dream mechanism grew tiring very quickly.
Yes.
Very true. The shame of it is that with some retooling, it could have been a much better movie. I agree.
Yeah.
There's got to be a better movie in there. There's got to be a better story in that book. Best auntie ever said, I went in hoping it'd be good. I was intrigued in the beginning. But then when I realized what was happening, I threw my hands up, rolled my eyes and said, are you seriously? Are you fucking kidding me? It was bad, but it had potential.
Yes, it had potential because it did start off interesting and then it just didn't have a message.
Because that Kevin Bacon and Amanda Seyfried, I thought, were both really good at bringing the little human moments in, even when they're just talking, when she's in the bath and he's trying to buy himself time to look at her phone. I liked that exchange.
Mm-hmm.
I liked him confronting her about the infidelity because it went not as you'd expect. He was very just cold. Sherry H. says, I liked it overall, but I was a bit confused about the plot of the movie. Like, what was actually happening? The house was alive, haunted, like a parallel universe. I just didn't get it. Soft sigh. Okay, so how many protractors do you give this movie? Because at one point, the guy that runs the general store gives Kevin Bacon a little protractor and, you know, tells him to find how uneven the house is because that'll prove to you that it was built by the devil.
Ugh.
How many protractors do you give this movie?
I'm gonna give it
0.5.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Check me out. I'm gonna give it 2.
Really?
I know, and I don't know why. I think because I really like Kevin Bacon. I liked what was in there that didn't quite land, and I liked the house. I enjoyed the experience enough of just kind of watching the pretty images.
Okay.
But it really didn't work for me. So I give it 2 protractors.
Okay.
If I ever went back into a different dimension or timeline to tell myself, to leave a note for myself, I'd sign it. I'd say,
right? Be like, this is you, dude.
Yeah. I'd sign it with a little secret that only I know about myself. I'd be like,
right?
Just really
future Bowser.
Yeah, exactly. I would. I'd sign it. Future, get out of the house. Future Bowser.
Exactly. Before we sign off, here's what's coming up on Altar this week. The brass elephant in the room on January 29th. A man sits in an endless black void until a peculiar partner is presented to him in the form of a chandelier. Then we follow you on February 1st. A famed influencer tries to escape her followers after the government conducts a nationwide social media shutdown. And then, self-assembly on February 3rd. In a self-assembly cabinet, bereaved parents find a monstrous substitute for their dead son. That's all for this week's episode of Altar Weekly. Until next time, stay altered.
You can catch new episodes of Altar Weekly every Thursday. Get it wherever you get your podcasts and make sure to subscribe and download. Altar Weekly is produced by Andrew Bowser with theme music by Sapphire Sandalo. Altar Weekly is executive produced by Stephen Michael and Lauren Palmer at Gunpowder and Sky.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.